The dark, cool pathways of Pelgrin, overhung with leafy boughs which blotted out all but the most determined of the sun's rays, soothed Quentin's mind as he rode along. His sorrow gradually left him. He became filled with the excitement of the quest. Though it was still hard for him to accept the fact that he seemed to have a central part in it, he felt the same old Quentin, after all. He allowed himself to linger long in a kind of rapture over the tale of the mighty Jalakir, the Sword of Holy Fire.
Where would we find a master armorer to help in forging the sword? I do not recall your having mentioned that. Surely you do not contemplate that we shall undertake that task without guidance.
Quentin rested with his back against a mossy log in a green clearing deep in Pelgrin's wooded heart. Tolly was busily poking among the bundles of the pack ponies to assemble a bite for them to eat. They had been riding since sunrise, and this was the first time they had stopped.
I have an idea where we may find someone suited to the task. Does the name Inkith mean anything to you?
Inkith? Why, he is said to be the most skilled armorer who ever lived. He fashioned the armor for the first Dragon King, and he it was who designed Escavar's battle dress, which he wore in the wars against Goliath. Everyone knows that name. But is he still alive?
Oh, very much alive, though you make him older than he really is. It was his father, Inkith the Red, who made the armor for the first Dragon King, and for several kings before that. He is many long years in his grave, but his son has continued the work begun by his father's and has increased the renown of the name. It is no wonder legends abound wherever men strap on greaves and gorget. The armor of Inkith is known as the finest made by human hands.
Turwin smiled and winked at Quentin's look of unalloyed amazement.
But what say you? Will he do to make us a sword?
A slingshot fashioned by Master Inkith would do as well. Of course he will do.
They ate their meal and talked of the trail. Tolly said little, and Quentin guessed his servant was concentrating upon reviving his dormant trail craft. It had been a long time since the wily Jair had had an opportunity to practice the storied skills of his people. The little journeys back and forth from Ascalon hardly counted, for there was a good road. But where they were going, they would have need of his animal-like cunning, for there were no roads, no pathways, nor even trails. Men had not set foot in those high places in 1,000 years. Quentin was thinking on these things, realizing that just as he did not know how they would fashion the sword, he did not know exactly where they were going.
These mines, Derwin, where are they? How will we find them?
I have brought along maps, such as they are, taken from the old scrolls. This is as good a time as any to show you. Here.
The hermit moved to one of the ponies and withdrew a long roll of leather.
This is the way we shall go. It is very old, this map, and the land is much changed. Rivers have slipped from their courses and hills have worn away. Forests have vanished and cities have come and gone. But it shall serve to guide us nonetheless.
Quentin fingered the skin on which the map was painted.
This does not appear as old as you say, Derwin. It looks as if it was made yesterday.
It was. We did not dare bring the original, or originals, I should say. For this map is made from scraps Bjorkis and I have found over the years. The very age of the scraps made bringing them out of the question. They would have blown away on the first breath of a breeze. No, this map was made by the combined resources of Bjorkis and myself, and it is a better map for it. He had information which I did not. It is a lucky thing he came when he did. If he does nothing else, he has already helped greatly.
Derwin, do you not know that where the servants of the Most High are concerned, there is no such thing as luck and coincidence?
So it is. Give me quarter. I submit. The pupil has instructed the master.
Just to show you that I am not always so dull. Be it as you say, there is still precious little here to follow. I do not even see any mines indicated on it.
Very rough. But it is all we have besides the riddle.
Riddle?
Tolly stood over them, looking down at the map.
Did I not tell you of the riddle? Oh, well, I will tell you now. There was so much to do in so little time, I do not wonder that you feel ill-equipped to begin this journey. I thought I had told you. The riddle goes like this. Over tooth and under claw, wend your way with care. Where mountains sleep, sharp vigil keep. You shall see the way most clear. When you hear laughter among the clouds and see a curtain made of glass, Take no care for hand nor hair, or you shall surely never pass. Part the curtain, divide the thunder, and seek the narrow way. Give day for night, and withhold the light, and you have won the day.
It sounds simple enough. Where did you find it?
That we shall see. I am certain that it will seem more than difficult enough when the time comes to unravel its meaning. As to where I found it, you should know that already.
How so?
At Dekra. That is where I discovered most of what little I know of this affair. Yesif himself translated it for me.
He never told me about it.
Why should he? It was years ago, and I was a pestering young man digging through his library like a mole. I chanced upon the riddle in a book which made mention of the mines of the Ariga.
Those are the mines we seek?
You see, the blade is to be made of lanthanil.
The stone which glows. My people have heard of it. It is said that of old the Ariga gave gifts of glowing stones to the Jair for their friendship in the time of the White Death. Whoever touched the stone was healed and made whole. They were called Coen Navish, the healing stones.
Yes, that at least I have heard of. But I assumed that, like much of the lore of Ariga, the lanthanil had passed from this earth.
I think not, though we shall see. The Most High will show us aright. We must remember that it is He who guides us to His own purpose. We need not fret ourselves over much about the things we cannot foresee. The things we see too well will require our utmost attention. I have no doubt.
Fado and Ronsard, with a force of 300 mounted knights behind them, rode southward as fast as their coursers could take them. They wanted to reach their rendezvous with Lord Wirtwin on the third day, and then undertake to engage the enemy before he had a chance to travel very much farther and strengthen himself on the spoils of Mensendor. At midday on the third day, they reached the prearranged place of meeting. The knights dismounted and walked the white greensward while they waited for Wirtwin's army to arrive. Squires in attendance watered the horses and saw to their master's armor. Thedo and Ronsard had withdrawn under a shady branch to await their comrade. Ronsard dozed, and Thedo paced while the afternoon came on in full.
Has he not come yet?
No. I am beginning to wonder if we should send a scout ahead to see what may have become of him. He should have been here waiting for us. Instead, it is we who wait for him, and he shows not.
I will send Takio ahead a little, and see if he can discover what has become of our tardy friend. Perhaps it is nothing. You know it is no small task to mobilize a force of knights in a single day. He may have gotten a late start.
Let us hope that is what has happened.
Thedo did not need to mention the other explanation which came to his mind. Both of them knew what it was, and neither wanted to hear or believe it.
Your instincts in the ways of battle are keen, sir. What would you have us to do?
They turned and looked out across the greensward and saw a knight on a charger come crashing out of the wood.
Noble knights, brave sirs, I come from Lord Wirtwin. We were on our way here and were joined by the enemy.
How far?
Not more than a league, sir.
What was the disposition of the battle when you were sent to find us?
There is little hope. The enemy is strong and there are many of them. My lord was surrounded on three sides, his back to the lake that lies at the edge of the forest.
There is no time to lose. Marshal, sound the trumpet. We move at once.
In three heartbeats, the greensward was a confusion of knights buckling on armor and clambering into their saddles. Out of the chaos emerged a ready-mounted, fearsome host. Thedo and Ronsard each took their places at the head of a column, and the army moved off at a gallop, leaving the armorers and squires to load the wagons and follow along behind. The king's forces dropped down the wooded slope into a broad grassy bowl, lumped over with green-tufted hillocks, which fanned the higher end of the lake's basin. Once below the level of the lower trees, they could see that the enemy had indeed surrounded Wirtwin's troops, and were attempting to push them into the lake. Thedo and Ronsard ranged their army along the rim of the bowl, and when the knights were in position, sounded the attack. They came swooping down out of the wood and encompassed the field, driving straight into the thick of the enemy. Ah! Lonsard half expected that the sight of the King's Knights descending in numbers upon them would send the horde scattering into the wood, but the Warlord Gerd's men were seasoned to battle. They dug in and met the flying charge head on. Thedo forced a passage through to the shoreline of the lake and struck toward where Wirtwin labored in the thick of the battle. When Thedo reached him, the brave commander's horse's hind legs were in the water. Lonsard led his contingent around to the rear to begin a pinching action upon the enemy caught between Thedo's forces and his own. By sheer force of weight, the knights being mounted and the enemy on foot, Lonsard was able to join Thedo in short order, successfully dividing the Nengal into two isolated halves.
We are outnumbered!
Our horses and armor will sway the balance!
The blades of the knights flashed in the sun, their shields bore the shock of fierce blows. The tide of battle ebbed and flowed for both sides.
But we cannot hold them long! We must break through now! We may be trapped against the lake once more!
Hey, well said! Have you any suggestions?
A charge! Along the shoreline and then back into the woods!
Retreat! I would rather fall with my men!
Let us say that we are moving the battle to more favorable ground! If we stay here much longer, we will be pushed into the lake once more! They are too strong for us! Marshal, sound the horn!
The knights of the Dragon King drew together and pushed along the shore of the clear blue lake. Those scattered further afield disengaged themselves and followed in their wake. Several riderless horses joined the retreat, and knights on foot ran alongside, not to be left behind. When they had reached the shelter of the wood where the ground sloped upward, Lonsard halted and turned his men to face the foe once more. But the Nengal did not follow them into the wood.
What is this? They withdraw?
I do not understand. It is hours to sunset, but they are leaving.
Let us go after them.
Let them go, Lord Wirtwin. Whatever moves them, I do not think it is fear of us. They were giving blade for blade down there. They are not fleeing. It may be a trap.
We could crush them.
Nay, sir. But a moment ago, we were in difficulty to hold our own. That will not have changed because they choose to withdraw. Lonsard is right. They do not leave the battlefield out of weakness.
Thedo cast his eyes across the tufted field, now bearing the bodies of the dead and dying. Upon the mound they had just left, he saw a lone figure mounted on a sturdy black charger. The figure raised the visor of his plume-crested helm and turned his face to where Thedo, Wirtwin, and Lonsard stood at the edge of the wood. Then the figure lifted his sword with the cruel curved blade high above his head in salute.
It is the Warlord.
He taunts us.
It is a salute, perhaps. A warning.
The Warlord lowered his sword and turned aside to follow his army, now moving away along the opposite side of the lake, leaving the field to the birds and the wounded and the dying.
Send a party to bind our wounded and to retrieve the armor of our fallen. We need not fear another attack today. Then let us go back to camp and hold council. I would hear what Mirmior has to say about what has happened here today. He may have much to tell us.
Under their banners of blue and gold and scarlet in the council ring, the lords of Mensendor sat in their high-backed chairs. Escavar glared down from his throne upon the dais, his rough knotted hands clutching the armrests like claws.
The foe does grow each day stronger. How long will you wait, my lords? How long? Until your castles are burning? Until the blood of your women and children run red upon the earth? And to what purpose? Do you think that by hiding within your gates, you may save your precious gold? I say that you will not. The enemy comes. He is drawing closer. The time to move is now.
The Dragon King's words rang with surprising force and vigor, coming as they did from a man who appeared only half of what he had been, so wasted was he by his illness. The gathered lords, now all accounted for aside from Wirtwin, who had made his decision and was with Thedo and Lonsard, sat in silence. No one wished to be the first to go against the king.
Do you doubt the need? I will tell you how I perceive the need. I have sent my personal bodyguard, my 300, to stand against the Ningal. Lord Thedo and the Lord High Marshal Ronsut lead them, and they are joined by Lord Wertwin and his standing army of 100. These are gallant men and brave, but they are not enough. We must send tenfold knights and men-at-arms to stand with them if the Ningal are to be crushed and banished from our shores.
Lord Emeronus was the first to speak.
That is precisely the point we would question further, sire. This enemy, this Ning, whoever he is, we know not of him. How do we know that he is so strong and his numbers so great? It would seem to me that we would be more than prudent to send a scouting force to ascertain these and other details before embarking upon all-out war with an imagined enemy of unknown strength.
How well you speak, Emeronus. I would imagine, as you've had ample time to compose your thoughts, that you are quite settled in your mind as to how you will go. Lord Emeronus opposed the call to arms! Who else would defy his king?
Escavar's sudden unmasking of Emeronus's subtle opposition shocked the assembly. And in that moment, several of the lords who had agreed to join a coalition of nobles against raising and funding an army now wavered in their opinion. It was a dangerous thing to defy a king outright, especially one as powerful as Escavar. It might not be worth the gold they would save in the end.
You misunderstand me, sire. I do not oppose action where it is plainly necessary. When the time comes to stand on the battle line, I will be at the head of my knights and at your side.
Lord Lupolin, Emeronus's neighbor and friend, his closest ally in the council, spoke next.
If this enemy is as great as you say, sire, would we not have heard of him before now? That is the puzzling thing.
You also, I know, my lord, that your king has sent his own knights into battle should be proof enough for anyone loyal to the crown that the need exists. Why do you doubt your king?
Escavar stood in the silence that followed his remarks. He looked at each one of his lords in turn, as if he would remember the exact set of each chin and the expression upon each face.
I have said all I can, lords of Mancindor, and I have allowed others to speak where I thought most advantageous. I have nothing more to say. It is up to you. If Mancindor is to survive, we must not tarry. I will leave it in your hands. Do not wait too long.
He left the Council of War, deep in hushed silence. No one dared to speak until he was far away from the room. And then the arduous debate began. Emeronus and Lupolin and their friends in opposition, Beniat, Fincher, and several others just as strongly in favor of supporting the king's call to arms. The argument was bitter, loud, and long, lasting the length of the day. Escavar returned to his apartments in the castle to brood darkly upon the stubborn blindness of his independent, self-sufficient lords. With every league, the foothills of the Fiskills marched closer, changing in color from misty violet to blue above the mottled green of the forested hills. The party had set out due east, cross-country, toward the lofty heart of the rugged mountain range. In this part of Mancindor, the Fiskills seemed to rise sharply out of rolling hills, gently sloping upwards to their very feet. They were a wall, as Selbrachor had intended them, a soaring fortress against all save the most foolish and determined. It was this fortress Quentin, Tully, and Derwin dared to assail. Each day the land rose higher. Quentin fancied he could feel the wind freshen and the cool air of the mountain heights waft down to breathe upon them in unexpected moments. In the happy countryside with its small, well-groomed village, it became increasingly harder to believe the ominous events that had loomed so large when in Ascalon. Even his own experiences in the camp of the Ningal seemed as if they had happened to someone else, and Quentin had merely heard about it. If not for his injured arm dangling from the sling, Quentin would scarcely have believed the talk. Only at night did the sharp reminder prick him. It came in the form of the star, growing slightly larger night by night. It now seemed to outshine every other star in its quadrant. Hard and bright, it sent a corona of milky rays outward from its hot white core. Everyone must see it now. Everyone must surely feel the evil it portends. But by morning's light, the wolf star faded, as did all the other lesser lights of heaven. The spell of the glowing star was broken by the coming of dawn.
How far before we come to Inkith's abode?
With luck, we will sleep in feather beds tonight.
Are we so close then?
Quentin had no idea where the home of the legendary armsmaker might be, but the rocky highlands they were now traversing did not strike him as the sort of place a master armorer would be found. Derwin walked up the slope of a little hill where they had camped. Quentin followed, squinting as he moved out into the light of a crimson sunrise.
Do you see that ridge of bare rock beyond the near valley?
Quentin nodded. The ridge was a ragged gray wall which cast a black shadow across the green blanket of the pine-covered valley.
He lives beyond the ridge.
Not beyond it. Within it. Or very nearly, as you shall see. Inkith is a strange man. He has many strange ways. But he is the man for us.
You know him, Derwin. You have never mentioned him in my hearing until most recently.
Quentin regarded his hermit friend with something approaching suspicion. Not that there was anything at all unlikely with Derwin's being acquainted with such a man.
Well, there is much I do not mention in your hearing, my young man. Only half of what I know will fit in my head at any one time.
When they rejoined Tully below, all was ready.
If we are to sleep on feathers tonight instead of pine needles, we had better away. See how long the shadows grow already?
You would prefer pine needles, I would wager, Tully. But lead on. The day, as you say, is speeding from us.
Quentin, with difficulty but unaided, swung himself up into Blazer's saddle and turned his face to the warmth of the rising sun. Toward midday, towering banks of clouds sweeping down from the north in a long line, gray as smoke beneath and white as new bleached wool above, rolled high above them. The churning mass swelled and billowed, spreading a great flat anvil at its soaring crest as the fierce upper winds took the bank and flattened it.
There will be rain soon.
Do you think it will hold off until we have reached our destination?
Possibly, but the air is already growing cooler. Thunder whispers on the wind. The rain may hold, and it may not.
Then let us not tempt it further by stopping to wag the chin. Let us ride dry while we may. A hot supper will make up for a meal missed on the trail.
I am for it.
They had made good time that morning, stopping only to refresh the water in their skins at a rushing brook in the heart of the valley. Every time Quentin chanced to look up, the great gray wall of rock, glimpsed as a looming rampart between the shaggy branches of pine, seemed to have advanced dramatically closer. The party left the sheltering pines and came to a wild and rocky channel carved out by a shallow river, which bounced and frothed over black stones, round as loaves of bread. The tumbling water, for all its activity, rose barely to the horse's fetlocks, but it was as broad as a ward yard. Derwin struck along the loamy bank and turned upstream, parallel to the face of the ridge. Standing pools of water along the bank mirrored the bulging blue-black clouds overhead. The wind had freshened, and Quentin could smell the musty earth scent of rain. The stream angled around a sweeping bend lined with tall, finger-thin, long-needled pines that whispered in the rising wind.
The rain is on the way!
Our destination is not too much further, I hope. Perhaps we should find a shelter and wait until the first downpour has passed.
If I remember correctly, we have not far to travel. Look ahead!
The hermit pointed to the gray cliffs directly before them once more.
See? Where the water emerges from the base of the ridge wall? It is just ahead!
It appears a seamless wall.
You will see! You will see!
Unless we hurry, Inkith, the armorer, will greet three very soggy travelers.
They spurred their mounts ahead with renewed vigor as the ripe droplets splattered around them and made dark splotches upon their clothing. As they came nearer the place Derwin had pointed out, Quentin could see a fold in the ridge wall he had not noticed before. Where the stream emerged, the left face of the cliff angled away sharply as the right face overlapped it. From a distance, it gave the eye the impression of a continuous, unseamed wall. Closer, it began to open to them as they followed the river to the vast stony feet of the rock face. The ground rose slightly as it met the ridge. Pine trees grew right up to the very face of the gray wall. Soon they were through the cliff and gazing on a breathtaking sight. Despite the raindrops pelting down around them, Quentin stopped to marvel at the vision before him. A vast rolling meadow of rich mountain green spread out on either side of the stream, here narrower and more deep. Enclosing the meadow and towering above it on all sides rose smooth flat walls of stone, now blue under the black sky. At the far end of the meadow, which Quentin had judged to be fully a league wide and half a league long, stood an enormous house of white stone. glimmering like the white sails of a ship on an emerald sea.
That is Inkeith's home, and we are just in time!
They galloped out into the wonderful meadow, the rain, sharper now, stinging their cheeks. Inchkeith's house was as large as a small castle, an impression strengthened by the single stately tower which served as entrance and gatehouse before a generous stone-paved courtyard. Several smaller structures clustered close about the main house. These were also of the same white stone. The stream, running deep and quiet in its course through the meadow, formed a graceful waterfall as it spilled out over the sheer rock face behind the master armorer's manor. At the further end, where the water ran down into the meadow, a large wheel turned slowly in the swift current. There was no one to be seen as the travelers pounded to a halt before the tower. A portcullis of finely wrought iron barred their way into the courtyard beyond.
He keeps no gate man because he expects no travelers and has but few guests.
The hermit slid down off his palfrey and strode to the archway. In a nook in the stone hung a knotted rope. Derwin grabbed the rope and pulled twice, very quickly.
That should bring someone running.
Who seeks admittance to my master's house?
Quentin had not seen the slight young man dart out of a doorway across the courtyard. He held his cloak over his head and peered at them through the iron grillwork of the portcullis.
Tell your master that Derwin, the holy hermit of Pelgrin, and his friends Quentin and Tolly, I hear, to see him on king's business. Tell him we respectfully request the hospitality due travelers, and you had better tell him quickly, or we will be in a most unhappy disposition.
Derwin wiped away the trickle of water sliding down the side of his nose. The young man seemed to weigh a decision carefully.
You do not seem disposed to be unruly. Come in out of the rain while I fetch word to the master.
The young man disappeared into a recess beside the portcullis, and instantly the heavy iron gate began to lift. The damp travelers hurriedly stepped under the arch of the gatehouse to wait until the young servant returned. Quentin and Tolly dismounted and stood dripping in the dark tunnel of the archway. Quentin was struck by the spare simplicity of all he saw around him. Not a post nor portal possessed an inch of ornamentation. Around the perimeter of the courtyard, not an item was out of place, and the art itself was spotless. The edifice of Inchkeith's manor house was all clean lines and square corners. Clearly, it had been erected with exacting care. Not a crack or crevice was to be seen anywhere. To Quentin's eye, the effect was reminiscent of the architecture of Dekra, though not at all derivative of it. He was impressed with the clean appearance of all that met his eye. It spoke of a hand that left nothing undone, and a mind that saw to the smallest detail.
This way, if you please.
Quentin saw the young servant waving to them from inside the arched entrance to the manor hall. They dashed across the corner of the courtyard and joined him under the sheltering portico.
Come along with me. Take no heed for your horses. I will send someone to care for them and bed them. My master asks that you join him at the table in the great hall if you are so inclined.
Indeed we are.
Quentin was hungry, cold, and wet. A hot meal seemed like the most wonderful thing he could have dreamed at the moment.
Lead on.
The skinny, long-boned young man led them along the short passage to the hall's entrance, pushed open the iron-bound wooden door, and ushered them in. The hall was ample and gracious, but marked with the same unadorned, almost severe style as the exterior. Quentin gazed around in admiration. Several servants were moving about in preparation for the meal. A single long table with bankers along either side overlooked a wide and generous hearth in which a well-made fire burned cheerily. It spoke of a well-drafted chimney, for there was, Quentin noted with pleasure, not a trace of soot on the walls or ceiling of the hall anywhere. Everything was as clean as if it had never been used, and yet it was warm and homey. The appearance of Lord Inchkeith's abode drew a picture in Quentin's mind of a stern and exacting personage of regal bearing, a man of quick temper and a will as strong as the iron gate at his door, a man of precise and flawless judgment, one who would never suffer imperfection or blemish lightly, a man of power, strength, and grace, a man of relentless, fervent perfection, obeyed by all around him with unspoken efficiency and unfailing courtesy.
Derwin, ye old humble bard, welcome. Welcome, fair friends. Welcome to Whitehall.
Quentin turned, expecting to see the man of his imaginings. The picture so carefully drawn in his mind collapsed utterly as Quentin, with a rude shock, beheld the Lord of Whitehall.
You should have allowed me to accompany you today. I could have helped you against them.
No, Mirmior. You are too valuable an ally. You will help us more with your knowledge of the Ningal ways than with your strong sword arm. If you had been killed today, as many good men were, we should have no one to guide us in preparing against them.
I submit to your will, Lord Ronsard. I will obey. But I wanted you to know that I was not afraid, and that when the time comes for me to lift blade against my former enslavers, I will do so with all courage.
We do not doubt your valor, brave Mirmior. You will ride with us in due time, no doubt. Ronsard is right. You are worth more to us as a guide to the Ningal's mind and heart than as a sword wielder. You are unique. Stout blades we have many.
Lord Wertwin sat nearby and did not speak. His heart was heavy with the loss of many fine men that day. He had borne the brunt of the battle and was now bereft of almost half his company. After the daring rescue of Wertwin's troops by Thedo and Ronsard's forces, they had all returned to make camp for the night upon the greensward. As they sat huddled in consultation, sentinels had been posted and fires had been lit for the night's vigil. Thedo, Ronsard, Mirmior, and Wertwin turned once more to the brutal events of the day.
We cannot go up against them again as we did today. They are too strong and too well disciplined.
Disciplined? They simply fear their warlord more than they fear you. You can only kill them, but he has power over their soul.
Is he really so powerful? I have heard of such things in my time.
Whether it is true or not, I do not know. But the Ningal believe it. So it is for them and for you the same thing. They will fight to the death rather than surrender. And each foe they kill becomes a step on the long stairway of immortality, or so they believe.
Whatever gives them their ferocity, it is indomitable. I do not see how we can stand against such a foe. Though they are but lightly armed and our own men well protected, they wear us down by sheer crush of their numbers. We have lost near 75 brave knights this day.
Do not forget that you have only seen but a fraction of the total. 3 other warlords with their armies are abroad. When they have joined together once more, nothing will stop them.
By Azrael, what would you have us do, you savage? Are we merely to fall upon our swords and be done with it? If you know so much, why do you not give us guidance? Instead, you torment us with your lies.
Mirmior suffered Wertwin's outburst in silence. His countenance showed nothing but sympathy for the commander's plight.
I have said what I have said in order that you will not build any false hopes of standing against the Ningal in battle. They cannot be beaten in that manner. At least not with our numbers. I have not been idle in my long captivity. I have seen much of the ways in which men make war. I have studied those who have fallen against the Ningal, and have observed the things which offer greatest hope of victory, though few enough they are.
Tell us then, what can we do?
Remember too that we will have greater numbers before long. The council continues to meet, and we may expect help soon, I think.
That we must not count on. What I will propose now will serve us for the time we have to wait, little or long.
Well said. Begin then. We are ready to hear what you would suggest.
Are the soldiers of your country familiar with the bow and arrow?
Why, of course. It is a useful thing, but hardly a weapon to be relied upon in the field. It is highly inaccurate, and there's no chance against the steel of a knight's hard shell.
It is more suited for annoying forest creatures and for striking from a distance in seclusion. It is not a weapon for a knight. The bow cannot be managed from the saddle of a galloping horse.
Bows and arrows?
At least you have such weapons. Do not condemn the plan before you have heard it fully. I do not propose to take archers onto the field with us, but neither do I propose that we take the field again. I will speak most bluntly. You were lucky today. Your gods smiled on you. In all the time I have been with Lord Gerd, he has shown pity to no one and has never left the field if there was the smallest chance of victory. What he did today is rare, but not unheard of. He gave you a chance to regroup and ready yourselves for another battle, because more than battle itself, he loves a skillful opponent. To him it is no sport to kill a weak and defenseless foe. That is mere slaughter, and there is little immortality to be gained from taking a weak life. You stood against him, and he respected you for it. When you retreated, he recognized a most resourceful foe, one whose death would bring him much blood honor. He wanted you to regroup so that he could savor the satisfaction of your defeat. Like the vine master who carefully tastes the fruit of his vines, the warlord was testing you and found a match worthy of his attention.
What does all this have to do with bow and arrow?
They are the means by which we will snatch that savored victory from the warlord's foul maw.
Defeat him with children's toys? Ha!
Hold, sir. Let him speak, for I begin to see something of his meaning.
You are most astute, Lord Dedo. I propose that we do not take the field against the Ningal, at least not yet, not for a long while. Instead, we will harry them by night, raiding their camp and raining arrows upon them when they move to chase us. If we refuse to meet them face to face, Gerd will burn with rage. If we are very fortunate, his rage will consume him.
Where is the honor in that? To skulk around by night like low-born thieves, shooting arrows at shadows. It is foolish and absurd, and I will have no part in it.
This war will not be won on your honor. Your men died with honor today, and tonight they lie cold in their graves. How can that help you now? Hear me, my lords. Cling to your honor, and you will lose your land.
Mimir is right. There is no honor if our land is lost. Even if we die with valor, who will remember? Who will sing our praises in the halls of our fathers? We will do well to look first to the cause at hand, and lastly to our good names. I would stay alive to see Menzendor freed of this menace, however it may be done.
I agree, but I am troubled by one thing. What you suggest is well and good for meeting this warlord and his contingent. But what of the others? Do we allow his brothers to roam unchallenged through the countryside?
This is the most difficult part of the plan, my lords. It would be well if your council would speedily send the troops we need. But as it is, I can see nothing for it but to proceed against all the warlords as I have suggested, one at a time. The plan will work, I think, as it does not require a great number of men to carry it out. But we will need archers.
Most of our knights are trained to the bow, though few will readily admit it. We can obtain more archers if we send to Ascalon, which we must do to supply ourselves with the bows and arrows.
Then let it be done at once. In the meantime, we will withdraw and stay just ahead of the Ningal until we have weapons enough to begin our raids.
What? Are we to do nothing to impede the Ningal? Are we to sit by and allow them to march free over our fields?
They have been doing so for weeks now, Lord Wertwin. If we must bear it a little longer to secure our purpose, so be it. We'll have to risk that much at least. Besides, it may make them wonder what we are up to.
Yes, it will increase his wrath. What we attempt to do is to worry them so greatly as to make them angry enough to commit a foolish blunder, an error of strategy which we can seize and turn against them. And all the while we will wear away at their numbers bit by bit, like water dripping upon the stone, eroding it over time.
Your plan is a good one, Mimir. I will send a courier to Ascalon at once. Tomorrow we will begin schooling our knights to this new way of fighting. I only hope we have enough time to make the change.
We will have to, regardless. Believe me, brave sirs, there is no other way.
Wertwin scowled at his comrades and stalked out of the tent.
Do not mind him overmuch. His heart will mend, and he will be staunchly with us soon enough. Thank you, Mimir. You have given us wise and well-advised counsel this night. I think that, like Wertwin, I should not have believed you if I had not encountered the foe today and felt his cunning strength. I know now that you are right, and like Thedo, I pray we are not too late.
It is no doubt that you were a faithful minister to your monarch. He must have valued your services very highly, but no more than we do now. Before this is over, we will have cause to reward your craft and loyalty as it deserves. Perhaps one day you may return as king to your own country.
I can never go back. The land that I knew and loved is gone. Here I have chosen to make my stand, as I should have long ago in my own country. Then I was afraid, but no more. I have daily lived through death too horrible to tell, and it can never terrify me again.
The three men stood looking at one another for a long moment. No one spoke. A warm bond of friendship went out from the two knights to the man from Khasi Quair. They put their hands on his shoulders.
Good night, brave sirs. Tomorrow, I take up once more the weapon of my youth. For that, I will need my rest.
dumbstricken. Quentin could but stare slack-jawed at their host. He had expected a warrior commander, or at the very least, a knight well acquainted with battle and the needs of fighting men and their weapons. The person scuttling toward them across the expanse of the hall was quite the opposite of Quentin's mental image. Inchkeith, the legendary armorer, was a small man with a thin, puckered face and sinews like ropes standing out on his neck, as if to keep his palsied head from quivering off his thick shoulders. He was slight and bent at an unnatural angle. Quentin saw at once that this was because the master armorer's spine was curved grotesquely. He walked on spindly legs in a kind of rolling hop, and not at all in the slow and dignified tread of the man Quentin had imagined. But the man's hands were the hands of a master craftsman, broad, generous, and deft. They were strong hands and sure of movement, graceful and never still for a moment. These remarkable hands were attached to powerful arms and well-muscled shoulders, the shoulders of a young man. It appeared to Quentin that some cruel jest had been played upon the old man with the spindle legs. The brawny arms and chest of a plowman or a soldier had been placed upon the frail body of a deformed scullery servant.
It has been long since I've had the pleasure of your company, Durwin. But here you are, and I rejoice at the sight of you.
Ah, it is good to see you again, Inkeith. You have not changed a hair. I have brought some friends with me that I would have you meet.
So I see. Good sirs, you're welcome in Whitehall now and always. I hope you'll feel free to stay as long as you like. We do not have many guests here, and your stay will be cause for celebration.
The Master Armorer made a ludicrous bow and winked at them.
Master Inkeith, you do us honor. I am certain your hospitality is most gracious.
This is Quentin and his companion Tolly.
Ah, Durwin, you travel in good company. Both of you are well known here. Your deeds are sung within these walls often, as are the great deeds of all brave warriors.
The stories do not tell all. I did what any man would have done, and not at all bravely.
Yes, but it was you that did it, and not another. That is all the difference.
At that moment, a door was thrown open at one end of the hall, and a troop of young men came marching in as if they were soldiers drilling in step.
Come, you must meet my sons. I know they will want to welcome you as well.
The travelers followed their host. Quentin and Tolly, grinning with pleasure, were irresistibly drawn to this peculiar man, so unlike the exact and scrupulous order around him. There were 7 sons, all handsome young men and well-mannered. They did not speak except when their father directed a question or indicated that a reply would be welcome. Quentin greeted each one in turn, as did Tolly, and remarked that they were all like images one of another. Soft brown hair and eyes, full lips and brown cheeks, high, strong foreheads. And they all possessed strong, straight limbs. None had inherited their father's deformity.
These are my army, my treasure, my pride.
Their father beamed down upon them as they sat along the bench with back straight and hands folded in their laps.
And these are my gold and jewels.
Inchkeith turned and waved his hand, and as if on signal, a tall, handsome woman entered from the near side of the hall, followed by 5 beautiful young women.
My lady and my daughters.
When each was introduced to Quentin, she held out her hand like a high-born lady and curtsied. Although he felt foolish, he kissed their hands, to the glowing approval of their mother. Tolly felt obligated to follow his master's example.
Let us not tarry another moment. Be seated, good guests, and partake with us of our bread.
Inchkeith took Durwin by the arm and drew him to the head of the table with him, leaving Tolly and Quentin in the care of the young women. They settled together across the table from the young men, and all at once they began talking, asking questions about what was going on at court, what the fashions were in Ascalon, what news of the larger world did they bring. So inquisitive were they that Quentin could hardly keep up with their questions, many of which he had to confess ignorance to, realizing that he knew no more about some of their interests than they did themselves. Their questions spoke of a firm knowledge of the world and its ways, despite the seclusion in which they apparently lived. In all, Quentin barely snatched a mouthful of food under their excited interrogation. As the meal ended, he had formed the firm impression that this was by far the most remarkable family he had ever met. When all had taken their fill of meat and bread and broth and fruit,
The sons of Inchkeith trooped off together, and the daughters, along with their mother, began helping the servants clear away the trenchers and serving vessels. Quentin and Tolly moved to the head of the table where Inchkeith and Derwin sat talking.
Though I am grateful for the pleasure of your visit, I know that you did not come just to see old Inchkeith. There is business to be done, aye?
So it is. We do have some business to discuss with you.
I like nothing better. But perhaps your business is not so urgent that it will not wait until I've shown you some of my latest works.
By all means. I would very much like to see some of your achievements.
You twist my arm, sir. Follow me, and you will see something to suit your fancy, I dare say.
They left the gleaming hall by a side entrance and were at once in a low, dim room where rank on rank of polished armor stood emptily at attention, waiting for their knights to lend them life. It looked like the very armory of a king. So many swords, bucklers, helms, and breastplates did they see. Through this low-beamed room, they came to another, smaller than the first and darker. It contained lances and spears of all sizes and descriptions, and halberds without number. The long-shafted weapons were all bound together in neat piles like new-mown sheaves of grain, bundled and waiting to be thrashed. In the gloom, Quentin could see the steel points of lance and spear, and the smooth, sharp blades of the halberds glimmering as they passed.
Ah, here we are. Watch your step. Oh, there. This is my only true home, my workshop.
They had stepped down into a room warm with the fires of the forge. The room was easily as large as the great hall, if not larger, and it was filled with a bustle of industry, as the sons of Inchkeith and various servants went about their work of forging steel and iron into weaponry. There were tables and odd-looking devices which defied adequate description all over the place, from one end of the oblong room to the other. At each table and surrounded by curious trappings, a man labored over his craft. Here, a blade being affixed to its hilt and handle, there a wooden shield receiving its hide covering, and over across the way, a truncated knight was acquiring his breastplate. Quentin was dazzled by the display, for it was totally unlike anything he had ever seen. Inchkeith led them through the maze, pausing at each table to impart some finer point of craft to the workmen there. And wherever the eye chanced to wander, it glanced upon a shining example of the armorer's art. Quentin doubted whether in all the world there was anything to compare with Inchkeith's workshop. Quentin looked upon the table and saw among an assortment of strange tools whose purposes he could but guess, a long, broad sword, a mighty thing, fully a span in length. The hilt was jewel-encrusted in gold, and the scabbard was silver, engraved with scenes of the capture of a bear. It was every inch a work of excellence and skill.
Do you like it?
Like it? Sir, it is the most handsome of swords. A treasure.
Here, you may examine it more closely.
With his left hand, and lamenting that he did not have the use of his right, Quentin drew the sword from its sheath. It was made to be used with two hands, yet it was not much heavier than its shorter cousin, and was superbly balanced. Even with his left hand, Quentin could feel the lift of the blade, and the almost effortless way in which it followed the movement of the hand.
The blade is of a special steel I have begun making. It will shear iron. This one I have made for King Selric of Bryn. It is all but finished.
Inchkeith carefully replaced the sword and turned to them with a twinkle in his eye.
Now, I will show you my masterpiece.
Inchkeith hobbled from his table to a low arch door set in a recess in the wall nearby. As he passed the end of the table, he took up a lamp and lit it from a taper. After adjusting it, he proceeded to heave aside the heavy bolt which secured the door.
This way.
Inchkeith disappeared inside the blackened doorway. The three followed their stooped guide into a small round chamber, and it was a moment before their eyes could adjust to the darkness and the dim lamplight. When Quentin raised his eyes, he was taken aback. Before him stood the most handsome suit of armor he could have imagined. But that alone was not what took his breath away. Quentin saw before him the very armor he had seen in his vision. It was real. It existed and was flashing in the light of the lamp as if it were wrought from a single diamond. Polished smooth, bright as water, it shimmered before his dazzled, unbelieving eyes. Without heeding the others,
Quentin moved toward the place where it stood on its stanchion, as if the object had beckoned him closer. The armor, pale and shimmering silver in the lamplight, was without ornament or device of any kind. All its surfaces gleamed like gemstone, flat and clean, reflecting a luminous radiance. The helm was magnificent, having a simple slotted visor and a crest which was nothing more than a thin ridge from brow to crown. And quite unaccountably, from the shoulders hung a cloak of the most exquisite chainmail Quentin had ever seen. He could not resist touching it. He reached out a tentative fingertip, and the mail rippled like liquid silver, sparkling and dancing in the flickering light.
It is as light as goose down.
Who is it for?
Aha! There is the wonder of it. No one, at least not yet. I fashioned it after a design that came to me in a dream. I saw it and knew I must make it. I believe the owner will come to claim it one day. Until then...
I notice that it does not have a sword. Why not?
Inchkeith, the master armorer, cocked his head to one side and frowned.
Ah, you have touched it there, my lord. I saw no sword in my dream, and so made none.
Then come, Master Inchkeith. It is time we talked.
Escavar paced his inner chamber with long, impatient strides. He held his hands clasped behind his back and cast his eyes to the floor.
The fools! The fools! They will bring the kingdom down!
He had been 2 days in his tower pacing, worrying. He had eaten and slept but little, and his features, now more lined and tightly drawn than ever, bore the effect of his distress. Often he had occasion to anguish over the stubbornness of his nobles, but now he saw clearly that the fate of the nation lay in their hands, and they seemed oblivious to the threat. Once and again he lamented the power, or lack of it, that stayed his hand from more drastic action. In days of old, he would have ordered his lords into battle with but a wave of his hand. They would have had to obey or lose their lands and privilege. In days older still, in the time of the first Dragon King, the kingdom was ruled by the will of the all-powerful monarch. Then there had been no lords to question the command of the king. Ah, but before that had been the time of the Northern Kings, when each man, by the point of his sword, could become king in his own eyes, and the realm was divided into tiny territories of scratching, biting, self-important despots who swaggered about their principalities, spoiling for a fight and a chance to increase their holdings through the overthrow of a neighboring monarch. Then the kings of the North had united and formed an alliance, and had established order throughout much of the realm, for they all acted in harmony and for the best interest of the realm, and no one dared to oppose them, for to deny one was to deny all. To bring war on one was to declare war on all. The petty kings of the South could not stand against them. Eventually, over many long years, the power had become consolidated in the North, and there it had stayed. Escavar turned these things over in his mind as he paced the length of his chamber or sat brooding in his great carven chair. He paused before his window, shutters thrown wide to the glorious summer day. He gazed out across the familiar landscape of green rolling hills and the darker blue-green of forest. He saw the slow curve of the Hurwit flowing in a lazy silver arc away to the south, moving in its own unhurried time toward its own unchanging destination.
The cares of kings and kingdoms are nothing to you, great river. Perhaps they are nothing at all.
Your Majesty, there are lords without who wish to speak with you.
Allow them to enter my outer apartment. I will attend directly. They have arrived at a decision. What will it be?
It had been a long time since anyone had spoken. Tolly was curled up like a cat in a huge covered chair by the hearth. Derwin sat with hands folded across his stomach, head down. Quentin himself sat slumped in his chair with his chin in his palm. Only Inchkeith still seemed alert and active. He hunched forward with his hands clutching his long pipe, puffing a cloud of smoke around his head and glancing periodically at his guests.
I will do it! By the gods' beards, I will do it!
The suddenness of the outburst startled Quentin and brought Derwin's head up with a snap.
What? Oh, Inchkeith, you startled me. I must have dozed off a little. It has been a long day, forgive me.
I have thought the matter out most carefully. Be assured of that. I will go with you to seek the Lanthanil, and I will make the sword. How can I refuse, eh? It is the opportunity of a lifetime, of many lifetimes. If you are right, and the mines can be found, I would pay any sum to work the Lanthanil. You offer me the craftsman's greatest dream. Yes, by all the gods that may be, I will do it.
I knew we could count on you, Ingeith. We will find the mines, I am certain. The prophecy is being fulfilled.
Ah, I care not for prophecy, nor whether Quentin here is this priest-king you speak of. But I care that our realm is set upon by barbarians. By Orphe, that I do. And if this sword that I shall make can strike a blow against them, if it can turn the battle, then I will make a sword such as man has never seen. I will make the Jalikir.
Quentin listened to the two talking and said nothing. All evening he had listened, saying little. His restive mood was on him again, and this time he perceived its cause, his arm. Derwin seemed to forget that Quentin, the one designated to play the most important part in raising the sword against the enemy, had a broken arm, and maybe worse. Secretly, Quentin suspected that it was worse, that his injured arm was more severely damaged than the broken bone. It had been a long time since he had felt any sensation in the arm at all. It seemed numb, dead. He did not speak of his suspicion to anyone. Not even Derwin, on the night when his arm was reset and bound properly, knew that he had felt nothing at all, for he had grimaced and moaned mostly out of nervous fear, as if it had hurt him a great deal. There was something seriously wrong with his arm. He was forced to face it now, when all the talk of swords and prophecy filled the night. As he mulled this unhappy fact over in his head, the thought occurred to him that perhaps he was not the one after all, not the mighty priest-king foretold in the legends. Perhaps the Most High had never intended for him to be the one. It was to be some other, as yet unknown. Unexpectedly, the thought sent a wave of relief through Quentin's frame. Yes, of course, that was it. One could not very well wield the fabled sword without an arm to do so. The prophecy, if it were to remain true, pointed to another. Perhaps Escobar was the one favored by the prophecy. He was king, after all. The old oracle's prophecy had said that a king must wield the sword. That settled it. When at last they arose to take themselves off to their beds, Derwin came near to Quentin.
You were very quiet this night, my young man. Why?
Do we not have enough to trouble us, Derwin?
Aye, more than enough. But I perceived this to be a vexation of a different sort.
Inchkeith approached them now with a light burning brightly in a finely made lamp. Derwin accepted it.
We will find our own way, good sir, thank you. You need have no further trouble on our account.
The trouble, sir? He's just beginning? But I have chosen long ago on which side I will stand. Get your rest, gentlemen. I will be ready to join you on your journey in the morning. Now, good night.
Inchkeith, taking up the candle on the table, hobbled across the darkened hall, the sphere of light going before him like a guiding star.
Most extraordinary man.
Most extraordinary.
And they all shuffled off to their beds, where they were enchanted into sleep by the distant sound of rain on the stones of Whitehall.